Good morning and welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. I'm Mark Gunnery, one of the show's producers. Earlier this month, Mark took a trip to the Walters Art Museum to interview the museum's new director, Julia Marcieri Alexander. Here's that conversation.
You come into the Walters, 27 years, Gary V. Kahn, who probably in some ways left a very powerful imprint more than people even came before him, because he transformed the Walters. He transformed the idea of reaching out to the community, of opening up to the community so people can come for free, which meant working people started coming here who never would come before. But clearly you have your own vision that you've probably been mulling over for a couple of decades about what a museum could be and what you might bring to a place like that.
It's funny. I feel really privileged because I don't think that my vision and Gary's vision are antithetical or even in any way opposing. They really are. It's just layering. And I think our biggest problem is not how do you take good to great, but how do you make great greater? And so I feel really privileged in coming into this world that is both a physical and a conceptual world and a community world that Gary built.
There are a lot of things I was thinking about in terms of coming to see you today. And one was that the difference that might happen in the future with you here. I mean, you're a woman.
Everyone keeps asking me about how hard it is to fill Gary's shoes, and that's become kind of a cliche now that I say, well, that's terrific. Gary's shoes are fabulous. My shoes look completely different from his. So I don't think that there's – I just want them to be alongside his in whatever closet that may be.
So, you're a woman.
I don't particularly like loafers. So
I don't either, so that's right.
I don't know if Gary wears loafers, but, you know, I don't like men's shoes.
So you have your world as a curator and as an art historian is a very different world than his. Mm-hmm. He was in the Byzantine. You are in 17th century with a lot of dead white women, as you put it, right?
Exactly.
So all of that, I mean, that brings a different sensibility to how you look at what art is in different ways, don't you think?
I do, and I think almost more fundamentally than what my own specialty is, the world in which we live now in 2013 is an incredibly different world, even from that in which I lived when I initially came into the museum world in 1996, when I was appointed the assistant curator for paintings and sculpture at the Yale Center for British Art. I mean, that curatorial work, museum work, functioned one way then. And suffice it to say that I think there was less change between the 19th century and 1996 than there has been, when museums first opened, to 1996, than there has been from 1996 until now. And Gary, in particular, did a terrific job anticipating that change, shaping that change. And the Walters was the vehicle through which a lot of that change happened, frankly. The Walters led the field in environmental display, led the field in technology, still does. But even things that were innovative in 2008 are now completely old hat. And so not only is it how we experience art, but there's so many more ways to think about art. And frankly, there are more ways that people interact on a daily basis with art than there were 10 years ago.
And also this institution, I mean, it began as a place in some ways contemporary for the people who started the collection, but also as a place for things of antiquity and the Byzantium and that period. But it's always, we're in a community that is a really racially, ethnically diverse world. The museums were always kind of the bailiwick for centuries of white people. And we're in a different world, thank God. So it also changes the nature of what museums do and how you think about creating exhibits and work and collections that speak to everyone, how you make those exhibits speak to a diverse audience.
Well, and I think that the assumption has always been, and I believe it is somewhat incorrect to assume that museums were always built for elite whites, because the way that people interacted, whether or not it was right or wrong, but there was much more interaction among the classes when museums first came about. That has become more less and less true over time. So not only do we live in a racially diverse but not necessarily fully integrated society, and that's a big term, integration, but I mean in a kind of notional way rather than a political way. But from a class point of view as well, now when you talk about museums, you are inevitably addressing people's assumptions about class. I think that we're coming into a moment when we might be able to have some different conversations about those things if we're really honest about them. My children experience race and class because they grew up in a world where sexual preference, race, you know, being friends with people who don't look like you, who don't come from your culture, it functions differently from even the way that I grew up. I mean, I was born in 1967. My father was a college president. Angela Davis came to speak at Pomona and the Claremont Colleges. There were candlelight vigils in front of my house. There were bomb threats. There were, you know, he was the administration. And as a child experiencing that, but seeing the world change in front of your eyes and being part of that creates a different relation to that. And my children are one generation on from that. So I think the conversation has to shift generationally in order for the museum to be relevant. It can't just be, well, I go to the museum and I don't see anything that looks like me or that's part of my culture, so therefore it's not relevant to me. We have to honor that. But frankly, I come from poor white Southern economic immigrants from the 17th century who... You know, my father was one of the first people, if not the first person in his family, to get a higher degree, to get out. His father was unemployed for most of the Depression. And, you know, the portraits of King Charles the Mistresses aren't my people any more than, you know, than something else. But I want people to have a visceral, a physical experience in front of a work of art. And some of the most powerful conversations I've had have been with people of many different walks of life and said to them, what was, and I'll ask you, Mark, what is the moment of wonder that you had in your first moment of wonder, and what was that object?
Mark, I've never thought about that actually that way. My first moment of wonder.
Was it a picture of a journalist who came from whatever your background came from? You know, so what was it?
Oh, no, it wasn't any of those things. Well, there's a lot of those. I have a hard time pinpointing things like that in my own life. I mean, I think that it was a combination of discovering butterflies and salamanders, of the kind of revolutionary heroes my mother would put in front of me from her past, was leafing through books that when images came to me and they were just images of beauty that hit me. There were so many things. I couldn't pinpoint one thing. Can you pinpoint one thing?
If I were pressed, I think I would... I'm going to give what may seem to many people either offensive or a flip answer.
That's right.
But some of my deepest visual memories are of Sesame Street. And for me, the way in which that world came alive on television in my very, very youngest age, I am the first generation of Sesame Street watchers. It was transformative for me to look at the creation that was going on in that medium and how it sparked my imagination. My very first art history paper, on a more serious note, was I went to St. Peter's with my mom and dad in 1979. And on New Year's Day, we got tickets because we were Protestants. And so the Protestant Dutch convent, it wasn't a convent, but you know, the place where the Dutch Protestant ladies lived next to St. Peter's, because it was their job to proselytize Protestantism in the den of Catholicism. So we stayed there and they got us free tickets to the New Year's service with Pope John Paul. It was his first New Year's service. So we're going into, and my dad was a Presbyterian minister who, to his day, some of the worst arguments, my husband's an Italianist who works on religious painting from Italy from the 16th and 17th century. So big arguments between father and husband about saints and the paint, right. Iconoclasm, really. So I go into St. Peter's and I see this amazing place. It smells like incense. It's literally glittering. It's magical. And then there's Michelangelo's Pietà. And again, I'm not Catholic. I don't even really go to church. So I'm not at this point kind of understanding what the lamentation of Christ is and what the deposition is. And, you know, but the sadness of that mother looking at her, looking at this dead guy on her lap, and it's marble and it pulls you in. It's completely smooth. And yet the smoothness is the thing that pulls you into the depth of the sensation that's going on in this piece. So I went home and I had to write, you know, it was over. I missed school, so I had to write something about my experience. So I wrote a paper on Michelangelo. You know, he's not my favorite artist now. Again, heresy. But, you know, if I had to choose, there's that swath, Sesame Street and the genius and the creative artistry of that group of people who transformed the way that a generation of kids interact with TV, and Michelangelo. Those are two completely different experiences.
It's interesting. You are the first generation of Sesame Street, too, and for me it was Howdy Doody and the Mouseketeers. But
I watched reruns of the Mouseketeers. That was the only rerun on TV. That and David and Goliath. You know. Which Wallace and Gromit is a much better stopped animation situation than Davy and Goliath, but...
That's interesting. I think that there's a couple things going through my head here. And let me just start with the idea which you talked about Michelangelo and that piece of work, which I've never seen personally, but I'd love to see one day, is that as a historian, I'm curious what you might bring to how you're going to look at the exhibits here and the continuing exhibits as well as the new exhibitions that will come in. Because I'm constantly in awe of curators.
Me too.
Because I
don't consider myself one of those when I say that.
Right? But you are one.
I know, but I think that curators, really good curators, have an ability that I don't even have. They're just spectacular thinkers.
We went to see the Dogleff exhibit in Washington, and we were there for 4 hours. We were just completely sucked in and blown away. And because of what the curator did with that period of history, and all the artwork and the clothing and the costumes and the set designs and how that curator put all that together and brought it out alive with multimedia as well. Art is beautiful to look at, but it's also contextualized because of when it was done. Right. Do you know what I mean? Why did that happen then?
Well, and to be completely honest, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, writing my paper on Michelangelo. The reason that I became an art historian was that I loved art history. I loved looking at objects in the context in which they were originally created. I loved speaking French, and I loved, which I worked hard at doing, and I loved the idea of going, you know, taking a trip in time and being able to reveal how people who fundamentally are kind of the same over time, it's just their surroundings in which they live that change. And so I would go, when I talked about St. Peter's, I was really struck by the whole experience, which is what you're talking about when you went to the Dolyhov exhibition. What I'd love to do with the Walters, which is a personal collection, a deeply personal collection, created not just by two men, but by the world in which they lived. And in fact, William T. Walter's case, he began collecting with his wife. And we sit here under her portrait. That's Ellen. Uh-huh. And I'd like to, you know, resuscitate Ellen a little bit. Because how people collect is very personal. How people experience art is very personal. And how people live with art is a terrific way to think about objects as changing over time. So what I'd like to do with this collection that started with one person, but that extend, or two people, but that extended to being a family enterprise, that extended then to be a civic enterprise, that is not just about the here and now, but about human creativity over time. I'd like to try to inject even more discussion about the lives of the objects over time, inject what you found at the National Gallery, some really great interactive exhibition design. I mean, what I've heard about the exhibition, the Dolyhov exhibition, was that not only were the objects great, but the exhibition design enhanced that. And we have terrific people here. And the Walters already does great work in that area, but really continue to build upon that so that some of the spaces in which we have just cases of art start to speak to, you know, if you think about it, how was this material displayed when the building was first opened? How is this building displayed now? How could it be displayed differently in the future? And how did, you know, which objects did William and Henry Walters actually live with? We have this great house that you're in now that belonged to the family and in which Henry grew up and then he would come back to, and in which William died. In fact, he died in the room right next door.
Have you seen him around?
He does open this case once in a while when it changes whether he lets me know that he's around by opening up this case a little bit. I would hope that in the next 10 years, people could start to experience the Walters as individuals, not just as great cultural philanthropists and, you know, not just as men behind this curtain, but as men who loved objects, who went around the world looking to build their collections. Do you know anyone? You must know at least one person in your life who's a serious collector of something.
Oh, yeah. I know a lot of people who are serious. I am a collector.
And what do you collect?
Lots of things.
What's your favorite? Your collection of the moment.
Well, actually, I have a huge collection of butterflies from my childhood that I still have.
Wow. Thing with the pins and
as a kid.
And you don't do that now?
No. I don't want to kill any other butterflies.
And are you a fan of Damien Hirst?
Yeah, I am.
Those stained glass windows of butterflies are pretty terrific.
Amazing.
Pretty fantastic.
I collect so many things. I collect socialist memorabilia.
Fabulous. Wow. Yeah. That's interesting.
Certain kinds of painting, a lot of Native American art. What do you collect?
I grew up in a family of collectors. So I let the museums in which I work, do the collecting. I grew up with a terrific record collection, really fabulous 78s, and we have a couple of, I mean, I'm sure they're not high-end Enrico Caruso, but we had, he sang in my house, and then stamps, and then arts and crafts memorabilia, because we became kind of William Morris freaks in my family. You know, there's a fine line between collecting and hoarding. And so I like to leave the collecting to the museum. So I guess to answer your question, you know, what's the Walters going to do? I really want to use that terrific expertise that we have here, the educators, the curators, the conservators, and think about how objects live through history and connect that to how people live in this world.
Whenever you come into someone like you comes into a position like this, whether it's a theater director, an artistic director in a theater or being the head of a museum, you plan often a year and a half, 2 years out to figure out what the exhibits are. It takes a long time to put together an exhibit and to recreate what's inside the museum collection as it is, right? So it's going to take you a couple of years for your imprint to be even felt in a major way. Don't you think?
I think so. But I think one of the things that I'm hoping will be felt in the shortest term is that I would like, people's expectations about traveling exhibitions are really skewed right now around the world. Uh-huh. So a traveling exhibition, when you say, well, what exhibitions do you want to see? Impressionism and fashion, Alexander McQueen, treasures from the Musée d'Orsay, you know, the entire Van Gogh Museum here in Baltimore. Oh, the Cone Collection. I can't do the Cone Collection. I encourage people to go see it up the street. We have really, really great works of art that live here in Baltimore all the time. Right. And we've been focusing on, for all good reason, marketing ourselves as a place to come see really great traveling exhibitions. And I think because the worldwide expectation about what that represents is one thing, and what we can, first of all, we have great exhibitions on the docket for the next year and a half, but the Alexander McQueen exhibition is a multi-million dollar enterprise. We have terrific works of art that are here all the time. We're free. We're right here in the center of Baltimore in Mount Vernon Square. We need to be promoting the Walters. And we have great temporary exhibitions that are going to come, but I think in the next year and a half, most of those exhibitions are either focusing on collections that are coming to us as gifts, or next fall, we're really excited because it's the 80th anniversary of the opening of the Walters as a full-time permanent public museum. Henry Walters bequeathed it to the city in 1931, and we opened our doors in 1934. So 2014 marks this great museum's opening up as a cornerstone of the city's cultural life on a regular basis. And so we're in the fall going to be taking out things from our permanent collection and doing an exhibition on the founders and looking at it from the perspective of this was for Baltimore, sort of art for Baltimore, but it's all art for the whole Eastern Seaboard, because what the Walters has is completely different from every other collection up and down the Eastern Seaboard.
What do you mean?
First of all, what Walters' father and son were interested in collecting is very different from what other collectors were interested in collecting. If you take the Phillips collection, you know, that's really great Impressionism and early 20th century art. That's not really what the Walters were collecting. Frick, Morgan may be the most like Henry because they were friends and they were enemies and they were kind of ratcheting each other's collecting up against each other. I mean, it wasn't against the Joneses, it was against Mr. Morgan. Mm-hmm. But still, our collection of French academic painting is one of the greatest in the country, and that's not something that most people collected. They collected Impressionism. We have a Monet. We have a Manet. Manet's not really an Impressionist, but he's sort of a household name. But what we have are great Orientalist paintings, great Barbizon paintings, you know, things that right now are maybe not in fashion from the museum world, but really are fabulous, fabulous works of art. There's not another collection from here to New York, even to Boston, that has the kind of things that we have in that. Mm. We have a collection of antiquity, and I mean Greek, right, Egyptian, and Roman, that you can't find from here, from Richmond to Philadelphia. And frankly, what we have is more diverse. So we have fantastic ancient jewelry that most places don't have. And certainly you can't build that now. So these are little pockets of, and those are just two of the many pockets of fabulousness, our collection of medieval art, our collection of jewelry across time, our collection of ceramics and porcelains. And I mean, it's just, you could go on and on and on. We're starting to describe ourselves really as a collection of collections rather than an encyclopedic art museum, where you're trying to tell that story of the history of art from antiquity to the present. We can do that in great depth in pockets. And then there are other places that we don't have any representation. But that's what's interesting, because that's why this is a personal museum that is made for the benefit of the public, right? So it's that really brilliant private-public partnership. It's like it's an embodiment of the private-public partnership. That's what I'm interested in.
Some people are drawn to museums because of the exhibits brought in that are created from time to time.
And that's because we have been, since Tutankhamun and since Thomas Hoving, taught by marketing that the reason to go to a museum is to go see the temporary exhibition.
So where I was going with that was that, so, right, and so with this in collections you have here, you coming in as the new director of this museum, so you have to really kind of also think through, I'm not saying you have to because I know you're doing it, I'm saying you're thinking through what you have in this collection and how you and the others who work here are going to recreate that present, how you present that to the public, mm-hmm, in ways that are not being presented now.
Right, or they were, you know, when the Walters, again, under Gary's leadership, reinstalled the entire permanent collection.
Right.
I mean, that was essentially making an exhibition. That exhibition is now 10 years old. What I'm hoping to do is not only build a program of great temporary exhibitions that bring things that don't live here all the time to Baltimore, but also equally to create an awareness of the museum that is like that awareness that we all have as cultural tourists about the Louvre. You don't go to Paris to see the great exhibition on Barocci. You go to Paris to see the Louvre. Baltimore has two world-class fine arts museums and then a slew of world-class museums of particular interest. So the, you know, Visionary Arts Museum, the Historical Society, just amazing museums. We need to be thinking about ourselves as a destination all the time, no matter what's on, mm-hmm, because there's always something on. That puts the burden on us to be nimble enough to keep rejigging that which we have all the time, because people do want to see things in a new context. You know, we can use technology in a way that you couldn't in the past. We can create new experiences through technology. We also probably shouldn't be building installations that are so hooked to the narrative that if you take one object out, the narrative kind of breaks down, but the architecture of the exhibition space is so specific to that narrative that all of a sudden it falls apart. And, you know, so we need to be nimble. We need to be looking at all the different ways of doing it. We need to be involving the community in helping us conceive of exhibitions, either sometimes or all the time. And that's a debate and a conversation that I think we're going to have. I'm not putting my stake in the ground there. I'm just so excited about what's here. I know the Walters not because of the great exhibitions that you've done solely. I know the Walters because it's the Walters and it's one of the world-class collections in the United States. So we need to do stuff with it, which, you know, has been done in the past. This is why I say what I'm bringing is not, my vision is not rocket science, but it is really, I hope, refreshing, because it's just, that's what a new person does. It's not better or worse. It's just different.
And this is not your first sojourn here. You and your husband lived here like in the late 90s. You didn't hear that?
Yeah, he was at Loyola College as an assistant professor in the fine arts department. And we loved Baltimore. And there was one moment where there was a job open here at the Walters. And I had a job at the British Art Center. Right before I sent in my job application for that job here, which I might or might not have gotten, who knows, the curator at the Yale Art Gallery right across the street in New Haven called and said, I'm looking for a fellow in the prints and drawings department. Could you come, John, up here? So, you know, fate intervened and said, Baltimore, not this time. But we loved it so much that when it was funny in the interview process, there comes a point when the trustees, for probably the final four or the final two, I don't know who, they have to pitch the city. And I said, oh, you just don't even bother. I'm already a Ravens fan. I've been a Ravens fan since 2000. So, you know, don't worry about it. I'm in.
So you like football as well?
Oh, yeah. I like football and I like baseball. And I haven't been to a Ravens game. So I'm looking forward to some charity coming my way.
It should come your way.
We return to Mark's interview with Walters Art Museum Director Julia Marcieri Alexander after this short break. Stay with us.
This is Mark Steiner, and I want to invite all of you to join me for the 11th Annual Annapolis Summit on January the 8th, between 7 and 10 a.m. at the Calvert House in Annapolis for a live broadcast. I'll be interviewing the Governor, the Speaker of the House, and the President of the Senate about all the issues affecting our lives that will come before the Maryland General Assembly in this session. And it's your opportunity to ask your questions of our state leaders and to have your voice heard. So please, join us at the Annapolis Summit. Just go to www.steinershow.org for ticket information. The Annapolis Summit is sponsored by Stevenson University, the Maryland State Education Association, Alexander and Cleaver, the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Our production partner is VBC. Our media sponsors are WEAA and The Daily Record. Be there.
Welcome back to The Mark Steiner Show. I'm Mark Gunnery, one of the show's producers. Let's get right back to Mark's interview with Julia Marcieri Alexander, new director of the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore.
This is what I want to talk to you about. Was the Center for Community and Cultural Arts that you started in San Diego and what that was and how that translates at all into what might happen here in a different version?
I alluded just a minute ago to the whole idea of creating exhibitions with community members. And, you know, the Walters has already done that. So again, I'm not inventing any wheel. In San Diego, almost my first week, in fact, I think it was probably my first week, I was taken by the then director, the guy who hired me, out to a place that was a new kind of urban center. It was plunked down on a toxic site in the middle of what was essentially four or five, I'm not sure, neighborhoods, but that had become the home to 11 distinct different cultural communities. A lot of political refugees from Africa, a lot of Pacific Islanders, a lot, and it had been a traditionally African-American area. And then, of course, it's San Diego, so there was a Hispanic component. It wasn't necessarily a Mexican component, though. And then there were, as I say, a number of different African communities, and including a Chamorran community from Goa, which I thought was really terrific. Mm. Anyway, so I'm not naming all the 11 different communities, but it was, and they had started out by wanting to create a center for community change, in which the neighborhoods and the individuals in the neighborhoods were given an opportunity to buy into, to become stockholders, shareholders in this community center. So it was a foundation that founded it, and then they were going to sunset out after the neighborhood had bought in and ran it themselves. So this was all really terrific. Joe and Vi Jacobs gave the seed money. It was really fabulous. They developed a way of working called the Learning Partnership, where they were facilitated by staff members from the organization. And then the community groups would come together and they'd talk about what they wanted. Obviously, not everything gets done. Right. But, you know, right. So it was a listening process. It was a doing process. But these partnerships actually created this vehicle. And they would call it, this was a Center for Neighborhood Change. So an innovation. So it's the Jacobs Center for Neighborhood Innovation. That's the title of this place. So I went out there, and they said to me very clearly, we figured out about a year in the process that the one thing that all of these different, sometimes even in their original areas, warring peoples, mm-hmm. the one thing that they all shared was a pride and an understanding of their culture. And so the only thing that we could bring people together around, or the most powerful thing that we could bring people together around, was art and culture. And so whenever there was a difficult conversation, they would also have a kind of arts and culture festival. They wanted to partner largely through the vision of my former director, Derek Cartwright, who's now back in San Diego, and foundation. Pete Ellsworth was the head of the Benbow Foundation, Legler Benbow Foundation. They came together with the leaders of this particular JCNI, and they said, okay, how can the museums in Balboa Park come together with this community to create something that would result in people in these neighborhoods feeling like they can come to the museums in Balboa Park and have them be their place. So, of course, the first thing that we decided was that we were having an exhibition on Black womanhood, right? It was a terrific exhibition. And, you know, as museum professionals, at the museum. It was from Dartmouth College, was terrific, mainly contemporary art by women of African descent, some of whom lived in Africa, some of whom did not, you know, so it was really interesting. It was about women. You asked me about being a woman. It was about women's art, but also African art, and then also art from the African diaspora. So there were African Americans, there were Afro-Australians. I mean, really interesting. So of course we thought, and this is where it was when I arrived, we're going to send part of this exhibition to this neighborhood and to the center and actually have it in two places. Well, it became really evident that felt like, well, are you really going to send us the best objects? Are you going to send us, you know, list B, and you guys are going to have list A? And, you know, because there were constraints. They don't have full-time security. They didn't have, so there were the art constraints. But they became very quickly not the logistical constraints, but the intellectual issues of, hey, we're going to get B and you're going to get A. Right. So really, we're not going to be going in any different way. So what we ended up doing was we sat down, and after 2 years of just talking, we figured out what we needed to do, which took another 2 years to do, which was, first of all, we needed to realize that the it that we were all striving for was not the product. It wasn't a gallery in the space. It wasn't what projects we were going to do. It was the process and the relationships. And it wasn't something physical. It was really personal. And it was the conversations that we had. And it was understanding that actually there's a big diversity within that conversation. You know, someone actually said, look, you have an exhibition of African art. That doesn't speak to me. I'm African American. That's not the same. Well, of course, that's right. But, you know, you have to feel comfortable to say that before so you have to create the space in which that's said. And so it took us 2 years to get there. And then we finally figured out what we wanted to do was to bring objects from the museum that were selected by a kind of group that was curators from the various museums in Balboa Park and individuals from the community who had self-selected. And they spent a year deciding on which objects. They brought objects from the museums, and then community members proposed objects that they had in their own collections. Oh. And it was about rites of passage. And so we had a space, we had a gallery, and we curated this exhibition in there. And now it's actually, the exhibition went to the Museum of Man in Balboa Park. So it ended up having two venues, one in the center and one at the Museum of Man. And it was a terrific thing. But for me, the exhibition was really, again, it was the deep relationships and the trust that those people who were involved in this, the museum curators, the museum educators, the museum administrators, the museum trustees, and all of the different levels of people who were involved at the Jacobs Center coming together, and we all felt like we were part of the same enterprise. And that was more meaningful than any given space and project. So I hope that we can get to some projects and we can get to some spaces and we can get to that, but we need to do that together. We need to go for that, which is deep engagement with people.
You have a lot of work to do.
I remember I watched Sesame Street when I was little, and it really shaped my belief system, right?
That's good. A couple of things about shaping your belief system. I'm curious about a couple of things. We talked about a bit before as we were walking up the steps coming to your office, which is Charles II and the women that you brought forth.
You know how they say that owners begin to look like their dogs, or they choose dogs that look like them? When you work on mistresses as an academic topic, the general thing is, well, you as an academic, you do something on which that you resemble. It's been 20 years of telling people that, no, I am faithful to my husband. I am not a mistress. It's all fine. He's really terrific.
Once when I met you at dinner.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is he still working? Does he find a place to curate?
Well, he's curating things for other museums. Right now he has a terrific exhibition on at Yale, and if I can just give him a plug, it was just today his book was named as one of the books for a Christmas list on the UK Spectator. So they only pick very good books. So his book was, so he's today's an exciting day for him. He's doing exhibitions and books and projects for other museums right now. So
Charles II. And I, you know, I was looking, when I was thinking about coming down here today, I started leafing through the internet and kind of popping up pictures from just to kind of orient myself to what.
And really the question is, really? Yeah. I mean, he was, as a baby, they thought that he looked so, he was known as the Dark Prince because he was so, quote, swarthy. They were really, really not, they did not think he would have a good life because he was really, really ugly baby. He was not a terrifically good-looking man, but apparently he had it.
It was king, too.
Definitely, but he was tall. He was really tall in an era when people were not tall. And, you know, he engineered fashion so that the wigs were really big. And
yeah. What you focused on wasn't Charles II. Was the women. And the women in these portraits, a lot of them were very beautiful women, his mistresses, some of them.
Yeah, some of them.
But part of what you clearly wanted to do was to not just be these women or these portraits or these mistresses, but bring these women to life. Mm-hmm. Who were these women? Mm-hmm. What did they represent? More than just these pictures of, you know.
So again, I grew up in the 70s. Feminism, you know, I remember you were either for ERA or you were not. And that seemed to me really breaking something down that's incredibly complicated into something that's, yes, I mean, I was for ERA, so that's fine. But these women, this was a time when women were not allowed to own property. They were, once they were married, they had no legal rights of their own. And that went from the wealthiest woman in the land to the poorest woman in the land. And they were all lumped together as one group of people. And what I found really interesting was that, you know, there are spaces where people can make something for themselves and find, create an identity. And, you know, whatever you think about that, that's a different issue. But these were women who not only, in their own time, had created spaces for themselves, but that had been, you know, that achievement had been completely swept away, largely by 18th, 19th, and 20th century historians, not by the people of their own time. So there was kind of a 200-year damping down of these women, and I felt that way of looking at these paintings really skewed our understanding of how life occurred in that time. I was really interested in bringing that together and recovering these women's lives from these art historians, usually men, in fact, almost all men, who wrote these books about these women and used the paintings to illustrate the point that these were wanton women, that these were loose, amoral women. You know, should we really be discussing whether or not someone was moral or not in 1660? I mean, hello. It just seems like, okay, yes, probably not a good idea. But to use a really good example, Charles II's mistress from 1659 until 1666 was a woman who was married to a man who was ennobled because she was Charles II's mistress. So he wouldn't have been ennobled on his... I mean, he was a really loyal servant. I mean, I actually feel sorry for him because he was a really loyal servant to the king. He got nothing because of that service. He got it all because he was related to her. So, I mean, that's really kind of powerful, right? I mean, and she had six children by the king, all of whom are the ancestors of the highest level of nobility in England today. You know, she became Duchess of Cleveland in her own right, because of her relationship with him. Now, this whole while, his poor wife is barren. She has no kids of her own. And when she stepped off the boat, he remarked that she looked like a bat because of the style of dress that she was wearing. And on the wedding night, if this is on the radio, you can put some of these pictures on so people can see. Yeah, exactly. We can send you to the web pictures. But... you know, she, on her wedding night, here his mistress, the woman, my subject, she was pregnant, and she and Charles II were weighing each other on scales to see who was heaviest. She didn't light a bonfire in honor of the queen's arrival. You know, so I mean, it was really sucky for this little queen who was 16 or 17 at the time. I mean, that was kind of stinky. Yeah. So it's not that there was that it was a nice time necessarily, but I was really interested in, again, kind of uncovering the lives of these women and looking at their paintings and the process of portrait painting as one in which people could assert themselves. And it's not just a mirror. You know, when you have a picture taken of you, it's a little bit different now with Instagram and all of that, right? But you do make a selection, right? I mean, you have pictures you like, Yes. And you have, I'm sure that you have chosen those pictures or been asked to help choose the pictures that are of you in your professional capacity. You don't just let them put, you know, your child's snapshot of you from the bathtub, you know, up, right? There's a selection. You're complicit in that. Well, so were these people who would sit for a portrait painter for months before their portraits were finished. I mean, that's a relationship. So we need to uncover that relationship. So I'm really interested in the way that people interact with art, not just as being represented, but also how they are representing themselves. My favorite misconception is that when you look at Rembrandt's portraits, you really get a sense of who he was. Well, Rembrandt was genius. Rembrandt doesn't show you who he was. Rembrandt shows you who he wanted you to see him as. And that is fabulous. But that's what I was trying to get at. And I was trying to recover these women through the ways in which they allowed themselves to be painted.
And that it to me is part of the essence of how you can look at curating an exhibit or thinking about what you want to put on the walls and what you want people to see. But that is at the heart, essence, the root of how one would approach a period or whatever that is that you want to put on.
That's also about experience, right? When you come to the museum as a first-time visitor, you have one kind of experience. You have an experience of discovery that is fresh and raw, and there's no background knowledge of the objects in the flesh. The second time you come, you already have your favorites. You maybe have done a little bit of research about them, those works. So you're going to have a different relationship with those objects. You'll discover something else the next time. The third time you come, you have maybe, now you've decided that actually you really think that marine painting is not deathly boring, but you think it's fantastic because it's like a little movie happening in a painting. And that it's simultaneous narrative. So you see the whole battle unfolding in front of your eyes, and you read that the admirals would have these paintings commissioned for them so that they could at a dinner party stand there and tell you this. It's like watching Master and Commander having Russell Crowe explain it to you at the dinner party, right? So the third time you come, you're like, wow, I can see Russell Crowe. I am Russell Crowe. Nobody really wants to be Russell Crowe now, but that's its own thing. And then it just builds upon itself and builds upon itself. The thing that breaks my heart the most is the person who says, you know, I went to the Walters 10 years ago. It was fantastic. That's a one-time visit. We have failed in creating a place that is compelling and interesting and that drives you back over and over and over. We failed in our mission to ask you what will you discover if you only come once. And so that's what I want to do.
That's exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing what you do. We all are.
Thank you. And I really want everyone to feel like this is their place and it's free and you can come in for a minute. You can come in for 5 hours. I get bored. Just FYI, my museum fatigue, about an hour and a half. So even a museum director gets museum fatigue. It's okay. It's a technical term, museum fatigue. You know, so it's okay. Everyone's a normal person when they walk in the door.
One last thing before I forget. So you probably can't answer this question, but I'll ask you anyway. So what are your ideas about what you want to do the next 2-3 years here? Just in terms of, are there pieces you want to bring in? Are there stories you want to tell? Are the things rumbling inside of you in terms of you haven't even kind of quite defined yet about the stories you want this museum to tell, that you want to tell here?
I want to continue to listen to what people want from the Walters. And so I've said that I want to address what I'll call the kind of looky-loo aspect of all of us, which is, oh gosh, how do people live? So, you know, we have this, you're sitting in this great room. I sit in this room all the time and, you know, William Walters comes and opens my door. I want people to see this. So I'd like for people to come and experience the Walters as a private institution and a public institution and an institution about human civilization and creativity. So that's a kind of layering. I think we will be seeing new installations of the works of art that live here. And I think what I'm hoping we can do is bring in really terrific art from outside, maybe one painting, maybe 80 paintings, mm-hmm. but that give us a better understanding of this collection. So everything comes back to here. So when you come to a permanent collection that brings great works from elsewhere, you go up into the galleries and you see something that lives here that is yours with a different eye. And so creating that synergy between what's from outside and what's from inside, and making that apparent. Also, you know, we have this great conservation department, and what people like most about some of what people like most about our exhibitions are how are objects made? Why does this look this way? In our Fayum exhibition right now, there are some terrific cases that show you through digital reproduction. Again, technology allows us to do something that we couldn't do 10 years ago. What this would have looked like, but because of the inherent quality of the materials, we can never see that again. So what I'll also call, I see, I'm all about popular culture. I watch TV unabashedly. I don't have much time to do that now, so I'm a little bit out of it. But, you know, the CSI quality of, or I guess if you're not a, if you're a CBS watcher, the NCIS quality, right? The investigative side of art history, and art making is something that the Walters can do really, really well. Yeah. And so we have this conservation window. One of the things that drives attendance here is people who come upon, by accident, the conservation window when it's open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then they bring people back because they had such a great experience seeing a conservator working on something in our permanent collection and talking to them about it. The fact that these are not just put on the walls by some other person whom you never see in the back room, and that you're supposed to understand the narrative of what's going on, and that this is not a place that functions without people. So this is a place of people and for people. And our tools are the works of art, but they're everyone's. Everyone comes to them and is should feel validated that their opinion is okay. You know, there's levels of knowledge, but that doesn't negate that if you hate marine painting, I'm going to try really hard to convince you of how fantastic it is. And we're going to go see Master and Commander. and we're going to stand in front of Van de Velde. And we're going to just be really excited about that.
You have to do that sometime.
Okay.
I'm not a huge fan of marine painting.
Yet.
One thing I want to forget, Jacob Lawrence, mm-hmm. This exhibit coming, right?
It's here now. We have terrific collectors in this city,
and
I don't care if they're hoarders or not. Their collections are just fabulous.
Eddie and Sylvia have an incredible collection.
Eddie and Sylvia Brown are, first of all, among the world's greatest philanthropists, and I think we should all feel really proud to live in the same city as Eddie and Sylvia and their family.
Yeah.
And to thank them every time you see them, because I go out in Baltimore and I think, wow, this city is what it is because of Eddie and Sylvia. And they have a terrific collection of art from artists of African descent, African Americans, the whole thing. And Jacob Lawrence is one of the greatest artists of the 20th century, color aside, right? I mean, he is a terrific artist, and they've been really generous in lending us a series from the Genesis series, which is a series of prints, reproductive prints, that create the story of Genesis, so a biblical story. But it's also about Lawrence's physical experience as a child. So again, it can be a story for those who are interested in the biblical story. It can be a story in those who are interested in graphic design, because they're fantastic. The way he works with color and objects is just super. It can be a story for people who remember going to church in the 1930s. It can be, you know, all of those things. But he is one of the greatest African-American artists of the 20th century as well. And we are really privileged to have that here. So, until April.
I'm glad you joined us in Baltimore. Thank you for coming, if you're being here.
Okay. Right. Thank you so much, Mark, for having me on. Thanks.
That was Mark Steiner interviewing Walters Art Museum director Julia Marcieri Alexander earlier this month at the Walters. We have to take a short break, but stay tuned. There's more Mark Steiner Show coming up next.